Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back like a boomerang. I am your host, UAP Gerb, and I'd like to welcome you to the second episode of the Alien and UFO Obscure Oddities Iceberg. If you missed level one, I recommend checking that out first. I will put the video link in the video description. Join me as we tackle layer two today. We're going to have some strange UFO cases. We're going to have some weird stuff. We're going to have some sightings that I don't necessarily care for, and I'm going to tell you when I don't like the entry, but we are going to call this layer the Enjoyer. Before we get into everything, please consider liking and subscribing. The first two videos on my channel have done very well, and I'm very happy about that. I plan to finish up this iceberg and then move back to some interesting documentaries. I did a poll, and looks like some people want to see UAPs in the private sector, so boy, do I have some good stuff to touch on for that. So join me as we tackle the Enjoyer layer of the Alien and UFO Obscure Oddities Iceberg. Japan Airlines Cargo Flight 1628 Incident. I am thrilled we get to talk about this. This is one of my all-time favorite UFO cases, and I think it is severely underrated and underrepresented when talking about the phenomena. Before we get started, just know that Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine introduced this as the explanation for the sighting, and it caught on, and people think this is the proper explanation to this case. That what the pilot I'm going to talk about saw were Mars and Jupiter. Okay, so let's join Captain Kenji Terayuchi in his Boeing 747-200F in his cargo flight from France to Tokyo on the Reykjavik to Anchorage leg. At around 5 p.m. on November 17, 1986, Captain Terayuchi and two crew claimed to see a UFO approach their plane traveling at 35,000 feet from the left. What they saw and described was one large rounder-sized UFO the size of an aircraft carrier. To put this into perspective, about four 747s in diameter. Accompanying this enormous craft were two smaller lights, and the three followed this Boeing 747 for a period of 31 minutes. While traveling at cruising speed, Captain Kenju said the mothership maintained a distance of about 7.5 miles from his aircraft, but was essentially orbiting around his aircraft in a circular motion, sometimes at a constant fixed speeds, sometimes darting in and out around its orbit. It's worth mentioning that these UFOs were tracked on U.S. Federal Aviation Administration AN/FPS 117 long-range 3D phased arrays. The radar confirmed the UFO stayed about 7.5 miles in radius from the aircraft, maintaining that distance but occasionally changing sides during the radar's 12-second interval sweeps. Now, what interests me the most about this case is New York University physics professor Kevin Knuth published an article called Estimating Flight Characteristics of Anomalous Unidentified Aerial Vehicles, in which he tackles a couple famous UFO, credible UFO cases throughout history, this 1986 incident being one of them. As you'll see in the figure on screen, Knuth modeled the UAP's G-force it experienced during this circular motion around the craft. If the UAP traveled across the diameter of the circle, it was subject to 68 plus or minus 7 Gs. If the UAP moved in a circular motion, focusing on only the centripetal acceleration, the craft experienced 84 plus or minus 8 Gs. This is substantial. To put this into perspective, this is an incredibly high G-force sustained for 31 minutes. This amount of G's experienced by a human would kill them and be fatal extremely fast. In fact, 9 G's is the limit a trained pilot can handle during a sustained turn, and a sustained turn means a minute, not 30 minutes. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I actually don't know how much I want to go into Wright-Pat right now, because I would actually like to make a couple videos on this, but essentially Wright-Patterson Air Force Base has deep ties to ufology, crash retrieval, and reverse engineering dating back all the way to July 5th of 1947, where it is said that debris and bodies were shipped out of Hangar 84 in Roswell, New Mexico to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So I'm just going to give a little tease where Wright-Patt can be connected to the UFO phenomena. We can look at 1949 through 1955, where Wright-Patt and Battelle performed special metallurgical analysis on anomalous materials. We can look at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works director Ben Rich, where in 1993 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Rich gave a presentation stating, quote, "We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in the black projects and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. And anything that you can imagine, we already know how to do," end quote. What about the 24th of January, 1956, where Wright-Patt monitored a reported landing of a flying saucer in the Qadaghan province of Afghanistan? USAF attempted to perform an aerial view to determine if authorities were hauling recovered craft to Kabul, Afghanistan. How about the 28th of December, 1973, where Senator Barry Goldwater is denied access to UAP information at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base when specifically asking about a, quote, room, end quote, where it was stored? Goldwater stated he was scolded by USAF General Curtis LeMay and said, quote, "Don't ever ask me that question again," end quote. And finally, we can look at 2023 and 2024 with the groundbreaking legislation proposed by Chuck Schumer of the 2024 NDAA UAP Defense Authorization Act, where it's required that all legacy programs and any sort of program studying UAP or in possession of UAP divulge their materials and findings. And guess who the biggest proponent of blocking the amendment is? Representative Mike Turner of Ohio, the same district that represents Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, these are just a couple examples of Wright-Patt being connected to the phenomena. I have 5 to 10 more I could go over right now, but as an iceberg, we're just supposed to give a quick summary of these topics. I got a lot more on this. Dyson Sphere. Now, remember in video 1, we discussed a Kardashev civilization, specifically a type 2 Kardashev civilization that is able to harness the entire energy output of its host star? Well, a Dyson Sphere is a theoretical device that enables a civilization to do just this. A Dyson Sphere is a megastructure dreamt up by scientist Freeman Dyson. The purpose of the Dyson Sphere is to entirely encompass a host civilization's star, drawing energy through solar means, through fusion, not quite sure how. There's a lot of theory still on Dyson Spheres, but a large outer shell of a sun, essentially. And as limited as it is, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has begun looking at stars for signs of Dyson Spheres, for signs of an advanced civilization. Now, the feasibility of creating a Dyson Sphere currently is not necessarily possible with our current engineering capabilities, but interestingly, one feasible way to create one of these megastructures is to utilize von Neumann self-replicating probes that would be able to harness precious metals and materials from the asteroid belt and from various meteors and various moons and be able to self-replicate and create this sphere without any direct human hands in the cosmos. The Voronezh UFO incident is a famous UFO sighting and extraterrestrial encounter that occurred in the Soviet Union on September 27th, 1989. Now, I'd actually never heard of this incident, so this has been pretty interesting to read up on. Essentially, what occurred here is a group of boys playing football in a city park saw a pink glowing object in the sky, followed by a deep red ball about 3 meters in diameter. The ball circled the football pitch, vanished, and reappeared minutes later, hovering. The children then claimed to have seen a, quote, three-eyed alien, wearing bronze-colored boots with a disc on its chest, about 10 feet tall, and I'd like to stress the head was rather smushed onto the shoulders. Exit the object, along with a robot. It was thought that the children were the only ones claiming to have witnessed the craft and alien, but Lieutenant Sergeant Sergei A. Matvayev, sorry if I butchered that, of the police district claimed to have seen a, quote, flying body in the sky, end quote. Now, it's also worth mentioning that this supposed 10-foot-tall, strange-looking ET utilized some sort of firearm to make a 16-year-old boy disappear before exiting the area and departing in its craft. Now, the Soviet media TASS went crazy for this incident, reporting on it all across the country. I would like to add, seeing as this event occurred in 1989, this was during Gorbachev's tenure as the leader of the Soviet Union, so his move to a more free market economy allowed for a more freedom of press. So you gotta think that possibly because the press was finally able to comment and report on things that weren't directly mandated by the Soviet Union, they might have gone a little tabloidy with this story. But anyways, the Soviet Scientific Commission ordered an official inquiry into the incident. They were not able to find any concrete proof of a craft landing. Although radioactive cesium was found in the region, there was not enough to indicate a craft landing. And upon checking for microorganisms and spectrochemical measurements, nothing abnormal was uncovered. So I don't know what happened. It's an interesting looking ET, but I'm not quite sure if I believe the validity of this case. J. Allen Hynek, fantastic entry, and this is the man featured in the overview of this iceberg tier. J. Allen Hynek was the scientific advisor to Project Blue Book, the United States government's official investigation into UAP from 1952 to 1969. This was the most well-known USG-USAF UAP investigation study, and Blue Book was founded to determine if UFOs were a national security threat and to scientifically analyze UFO data. It's worth mentioning that during its tenure from 52 to 69, 12,618 UFO reports were analyzed, 701 of which were classified as unexplained after extensive analysis. Blue Book is a bit controversial due to the Robertson panel that occurred in 1953, which was used to strip UFOs of their special status and suggest that no legitimate evidence of their existence was available. Think of the swamp gas and weather balloon explanation and stigma around UFOs. A lot of this came from Project Blue Book. Not to mention the Condon report that we mentioned in the first video that essentially did the same thing as the Robertson panel. All this occurred during Blue Book's tenure. Now back to Hynek. In May of 1972, Hynek wrote a book and claimed that Blue Book was, quote, a cover-up, and that the UFO issue was, quote, glossed over. He says that Blue Book was a front for a more classified investigation group, possibly something called AFOIN-XSG, and was told to drop certain cases and, quote, not to pursue the matter further, end quote. In 1979, Hynek stated that the CIA's Robertson panel was concerned on public reaction to UFOs. They were, quote, handed down the unwritten law of the Air Force, don't rock the boat, play with it, cool it, don't get the public excited. Hynek stated that USAF purposefully debunked interesting cases as balloons or planets. Just think about the Japan Cargo Airlines incident. Hynek would also go on to comment on the Condon report, saying that the committee ignored key evidence. What's really crazy is on the 13th of April 1975, Hynek was told by Donald Rumsfeld at the White House that he did not have a need to know if there was a secret UAP study somewhere after Blue Book. Hynek would be extremely outspoken about the USG's official UAP investigation, even commenting on 1949's Project Grudge, one of the predecessors to Blue Book, saying that Grudge was, quote, less scientific and more of a public relations campaign, end quote. Hynek is one of the OG whistleblowers, and I have nothing but respect for this man. I have a lot more to say about him, but these are just a few of his outspoken comments. UFOs over Slovenia. Now, I apologize in advance. I was not really able to find anything on this subject besides a 1970s crop circle sighting in a village in Slovenia, or some Reddit posts from around summer of 2023 of some really grainy photographs of supposed UAPs. So I'm just going to skip this entry. I really don't know what to cover here, but maybe Slovenia is a UFO hotspot. I don't know. The Kimbaya Ancient Airplanes. I'm just going to be straight up with you guys. I don't like this entry, but I will entertain it nonetheless. The Kimbaya artifacts are several dozen gold figurines found in Colombia made by the Kimbaya culture, dated to around 1000 CE. A few of these figurines, which depict birds, fish, bugs, all of this, are shaped like an airplane. It is likely an owl or a bird. But these supposed depictions of airplanes are used by ancient astronaut theorists, I wouldn't be surprised if ancient aliens covered this, to say that some sort of extraterrestrial race that flew 747 jumbo jets was visiting this culture. That's all I'm going to say on this. I think these artifacts are just trinkets that are being misconstrued for something grand. Mystery airships was a craze that occurred in 1896 to 1897, where thousands of reports occurred of people seeing mysterious airships or airship-style UAPs. Some reports claimed to see the crewmen of these airships, describing them as human-looking. At the time, it was popularly believed that these mysterious airships were the product of some inventor or genius who was not yet ready to show his invention to the world. Now, while there were no records of sustained or long-range airship flights at this time, it is not impossible that these were just, in fact, prototype airships from some inventor. In fact, there were several successful manufactured airships from before this period, including Solomon Andrews' successful test flights of his Arion airship in 1863. But remember, the capabilities were extremely limited to what observers saw and claimed to see in the sky. But most of these sightings were explained away as hoaxes or misidentification of celestial phenomena, as you'd expect. So just because this craze occurred so long ago, it's difficult to find any recorded evidence of these airships. So whether this was some inventor or a series of hoaxes, I'm not quite sure, or whether this has some more esoteric explanations, such as the UFO phenomena expressing itself to what people would understand as technology at the time, as some sort of airship type things that evolved into saucer-shaped craft and cigar-shaped craft. I don't know. I'm leaning towards just a mixture of hoaxes and just the exploration of airship technology at the time by inventors. So that's where I'm at. The Aurora, Texas UFO incident is the first alleged UFO crash retrieval that I'm aware of. Okay, so our story takes place on April 17th, 1897, where according to locals, a UFO crashed on a farm near Aurora, Texas, bashing into a windmill. According to the Dallas Morning News on April 19th, 1897, the craft was piloted by one sole inhabitant who was deceased with his remains badly disfigured. But the paper still says, quote, he was not an inhabitant of this world. According to this same article in the paper, the ship was too badly wrecked to form any conclusion on its construction or how it was powered. But it does say the craft was built of an unknown mixture of metal, resembling aluminum and silver, and must have weighed several tons. The paper also goes on to say that the town was planning a burial for the pilot the following day at noon. The wreckage was thrown into a nearby well, and the inhabitant of the craft was buried with a stone slab resembling what was seen of his craft. So is this story real or not? Well, I don't know, but in 1980, in a Time magazine interview with Etna Pegues, an 86-year-old Aurora, Texas resident, she said that the story had been fabricated, trying to bring attention to the town since a railroad bypassed it. And the town was slowly dying. So let's take a look at the investigation done by MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, a nonprofit ran to investigate UFO sightings. In 1973, Bill Case led an investigation into the Aurora, Texas crash. In this, MUFON uncovered two new eyewitnesses to the crash, Mary Evans, who told how her parents would not let her visit the crash site, but the parents went to the site and discovered an alien body, and Charlie Stevens, who was 10 at the time, who said he saw some sort of airship trailing smoke as it headed north towards Aurora. He wanted to investigate the crash, but his father made him finish chores. His father the next day went into town to see the wreckage. MUFON then investigated the Aurora Cemetery where the supposed pilot was buried. They found a grave marker that appeared to show a flying saucer of some sort, as well as strange readings from their metal detector. Because according to some parts of the pilot's ship were buried with the pilot. MUFON asked to exhume the site, but the cemetery declined permission. After MUFON's investigation, the marker mysteriously disappeared from the cemetery, and a 3-inch pipe was placed into the ground, where MUFON's metal detector no longer picked up metal readings from the grave. It was thus presumed that maybe the metal was removed from the grave, if there was some there. MUFON reported that their evidence was inconclusive, but they did not rule out the possibility of a hoax. So, think what you will of this case, I'm not quite sure what to think, but it is interesting nonetheless. The 1561 celestial phenomenon over Nuremberg is one of the first examples of a mass UFO sighting in recorded history. In 1561, a broadsheet news article printed in the Holy Roman Empire described a mass sighting of celestial phenomena. Residents saw hundreds of globes, cylinders, rods, and strange objects at sunrise. The objects flew across the sun, giving the appearance of a battle. Residents also claimed to see a black triangular object close to the ground, followed by a crash. Some of the other described shapes included crosses, small spheres, two large crescents, a black sphere, and cylindrical objects emitting smaller spheres. So what do the skeptics like to say this is? Well, some think this is an example of Carl Jung's mass hysteria, one of the first collective examples of a collective consciousness forming a narrative, while others like to say this is a sundog. I don't think the sundog explanation is likely, but this case is extremely perplexing nonetheless. Eric von Daniken is a figure we mentioned in our first episode of The Iceberg with the Nazca Lines. Von Daniken is the author of Chariots of the Gods, a book that proposes the ancient astronaut hypothesis, in which extraterrestrials made contact with early humans, influencing culture and settlement. Von Daniken proposes that structures such as the Pyramids of Giza, the Maui of Easter Island, and Stonehenge are products of extraterrestrial influence or extraterrestrial building techniques. He presumes that numerous pieces of ancient artwork and sculptures and so forth depict astronauts and their space vehicles, aka extraterrestrials and their complex technology. Von Daniken likes to explain the origin of religions as ancient humans coming into contact with an alien race so far advanced they seem divine. Some of von Daniken's claims on the ancient astronaut hypothesis and religion, especially the Old Testament and the Bible, are pretty interesting. Von Daniken will talk about Ezekiel's visions of angels and how these angels were actually UFOs. If you know anything about what a biblically accurate angel looks like, you'll understand that this would not be a confusing comparison. He also claims that things like the destruction of Sodom by fire and brimstone are actually a nuclear explosion. While I don't love all of Von Daniken's claims, especially those regarding extraterrestrials building or teaching leverage techniques on how to build ancient monoliths and megaliths, I do like to think the phenomena has possibly been here for thousands of years, and thus it's not inconceivable to think that whatever this phenomenon is has had influence on ancient human culture and religion and development. The 2009 Norwegian Spiral Anomaly was a curious and perplexing spiral of blue light seen in the skies of northern Norway and Sweden for a period of 10 minutes. This blue spiral looked like it was coming from behind a mountain, stopping in midair and spiraling outwards. Some UFO enthusiasts immediately began speculating that this was some sort of UFO or extraterrestrial sign, although on the 10th of December 2009, the Russian Defense Ministry announced it had been testing Balava missiles, ballistic missiles that had failed, and thus the third stage of missile separation resulted in fuel and exhaust coming out the sides of the missile, sending it into a spiral, resulting in this sort of spiral shape. I personally am happy with that explanation. I don't need anything else to explain this issue away, but who knows? Maybe it was ETs. The Fermi paradox is a question proposed by Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi in the summer of 1950. On one day, on a lunch break, Fermi asked, "If the universe is so big, where is everybody?" The Fermi paradox highlights the discrepancy between lack of conclusive evidence of an advanced extraterrestrial species and the high likelihood of their existence. I personally despise the Fermi paradox, especially people who fall back on SETI's inconclusive evidence, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's baffling to me. SETI is essentially looking at one conical section of an entire observable universe. SETI uses radio signatures because they suppose that other civilizations might use radio signatures like we do, because radio signatures carry information over a long range, when maybe an extraterrestrial species uses neutrino communication or something like that. So SETI is basically using a magnet to find a needle in the ocean. But a new form of SETI, called Dysonian SETI, essentially looks for techno-signatures from an extraterrestrial species. These are imprints of a species using advanced technology. Think of a Dyson sphere. But it baffles me that in a universe that is 92 billion light years in diameter, people will fall back on saying that extraterrestrial civilizations don't exist or we haven't found them, even though we've been looking, when we look through a tiny conical section of space and time wherever we look. It's absolutely absurd to me. But for the sake of this entry, let's entertain a few ideas of the Fermi paradox. One, the Great Filter. The Great Filter suggests that every advanced civilization goes through some sort of filtering process where the civilization will either kill itself off and die or traverse the cosmos. This could be something like harnessing the power of nuclear weapons or being destroyed or harnessing advanced AI. Two, and this one is really fun to think of, the dark forest theory. Essentially, ET races hide their communication signatures due to the fact they are afraid of something bigger, more powerful, and more advanced from them. So essentially, there's pockets of fire civilization in a dark forest that they don't want to telegraph their presence. Three, most alien civilizations are aquatic, and thus we cannot detect bio or techno signatures from light years and light years away. Four, we are early. This suggests that although we come from a Generation 2 star, we as humans are one of the precursor civilizations to this universe, that we are one of the first civilizations and advanced species to form. I think this is very unlikely, but fun to think about. And five, we are late. This theory suggests that we live in a graveyard. Essentially, all advanced civilizations have died out for one reason or another, and we are the last. Maybe I'll make a video someday like top 10 most interesting solutions to the Fermi paradox, but For now, just know that I do not like the Fermi paradox. I think it's limited. I think it is ignorant. Let's move on. Speculative evolution is the process of utilizing current biological knowledge of life here on Earth to extrapolate, to speculate biology and evolution of extraterrestrial species. Speculative evolution is often considered hard science fiction because it does incorporate real biology to try and determine what a species might look like on another planet due to its atmospheric, terrestrial, and solar conditions. This look at evolution is also sometimes used for educational purposes to hypothesize what some signs of early life may have looked like on this planet. A really good book on this subject is All Tomorrows by C.M. Kozeman, which explores a hypothetical future path of human evolution set in the near future to about a billion years from now. It's really interesting. Give it a read. The Anunnaki are an ancient race of gods worshipped by the Sumerians, Akkadians, Assyrians, and Babylonians. Now, why we're all here and where you've heard of the Anunnaki are from Zachariah Sitchin's transcriptions of the ancient Sumerian tablets, where Sitchin claims that the Anunnaki are an ancient advanced race of extraterrestrials from the undiscovered ninth planet in our solar system, Nibiru. Sorry, Pluto, but you are most certainly not a planet. But anyways, according to Sitchin, the Anunnaki came to Earth around 500,000 years ago to construct a base of operations in order to mine gold. The Anunnaki combined their DNA with that of Homo erectus to create a species of slave miners, now known as modern humans. The Anunnaki were then forced to flee Earth due to Antarctic glaciers melting, causing the Great Flood, which also destroyed their Earthbound base. And if you remember from our first episode with David Icke and the Reptilians, this man claims that the Reptilians are in fact the Anunnaki. So, what do I think of this? Zachariah Sitchin's translations of the Sumerian texts are known to be inaccurate and false to a very high degree. I do not think this is true. When I was a young conspiracy kid, I loved thinking about the Anunnaki and Nibiru and a mysterious extra planet in our solar system, but I think this is absurd. Again, what we talked about, I don't think it's insane to think that some sort of ET civilization had an effect on ancient man or even possibly tampered with our DNA. But I do not believe in the story of the Anunnaki needing to create humans to mine gold for them. The Galactic Federation is pretty self-explanatory. Think of Star Wars, think of a network of extraterrestrial species that communicate, trade, interact, possibly war, all under one global banner of some governing body. Now, what's interesting about a supposed Galactic Federation in our Milky Way galaxy, in 2020, former head of Israel's military space program, Haim Eshed, in an interview said that humans weren't ready for contact with extraterrestrials. In this interview, he claimed there was a Galactic Federation of extraterrestrials, some of which already existed on Earth. There's also a supposed ex-CIA agent, John Ramirez, who has made similar claims of a present Galactic Federation. I think it's quite plausible we exist in a galaxy that has a present Galactic Federation. I don't know for sure. I don't know if anyone does. Maybe some people do. But I think it's quite possible, and I would be fascinated to understand how a galactic network of extraterrestrials trade and interact with one another, if there's a common language, if there's common practices and culture and society. It's fascinating to think about. Indigo children, I'm going to be straight up honest with you guys. I have no idea why this was included in the iceberg, especially the second layer of this iceberg. I guess indigo children are weird little kids who possess special, unusual, and sometimes supernatural traits and abilities like telekinesis. This idea is based on a concept in the 70s by Nancy Ann Tapp, who said she began to notice indigo children around the late 1960s. Look, I have no idea how this is supposed to be related to UFOs or extraterrestrials. My guess is maybe these are like hybrid children. I don't know. I'm not a fan of this entry. I think it's really stupid, if I'm being honest, but gotta cover it anyways. Gary McKinnon is a Scottish hacker who, in 2002, perpetrated the biggest military computer hack of all time. McKinnon hacked numerous systems in the US military to look for a UFO cover-up and free energy suppression. During his hack, McKinnon was able to hack into 97 US military and NASA computers over a 13-month period between February 01 and March 02, all while in the house of his girlfriend's aunt in London. The US military cybersecurity division at the time was playing stupid games and winning stupid prizes. Gary McKinnon was able to guess basic passwords such as password to hack into some terminals. Anyways, what did McKinnon say he found? Well, to start, McKinnon acted on a hunch that one Donna Hare, who was a former NASA launch photographic specialist, said that in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center, there was a lab set aside specially for airbrushing out UFOs from high-resolution satellite imagery. McKinnon found and was able to access machines from Building 8, upon which he found folders titled Raw and Processed. In these folders, he would find images around the size of 250 megabytes, which at the time would have taken a long time, as his terminal was only able to download about 1 megabyte every 5 minutes. McKinnon began to find a single image in the raw folder. He found what appeared to be a blue and white planet with a black backdrop. Superimposed onto that was a tubular form that was metallic white and had domes around its central circumference and at its ends. The craft had no rivets or seams and looked futuristic. Though, of course, due to the low resolution and number of shades, McKinnon couldn't make out too much detail from the imagery. At this same time is when he saw his cursor began to move, click out, and he was thus caught. Now, besides this incident which occurred at the end of his hack, McKinnon was also able to find some other extremely interesting things. He found a 300 military personnel ledger that was a secret program called the Solar Warden. This program was a US military secret battalion in space that was used by the US Navy Network and Space Operations Command, the NNSOC. In this, McKinnon found the Pentagon files storing, quote, extraterrestrial officers and, quote, contact between fleets. Among these were two ship names, the USSS, not USS, the USSS with the third letter maybe standing for space, LeMay and Hillenkoetter. McKinnon said that the extraterrestrials officer list was not a list of aliens, but a list of officers who do not work on Earth. They serve a fleet of spaceships that operate outside of this planet. There is no doubt that McKinnon believes he is telling the truth, and I don't know. I think there could be some credibility to what he says, especially the photos where UAP are airbrushed out of high-res satellite imagery. Chris Mellon has commented on similar things, that 4K satellite footage of UAP exists but are classified or tampered with. Heaven's Gate. Now, I can't do too much justice to Heaven's Gate because there are some pretty incredible documentaries on YouTube about this cult, so I will just give an official overview. Heaven's Gate was a UFO cult started by Bonnie Nettles in 1974. The group believed that they could transform themselves into immortal extraterrestrial beings by rejecting their human nature, and they would ascend to heaven, referred to as the next level or the next evolutionary level above human. In 1997 and the passing of the Halley-Bopp comet, the group thought that a UFO trailing the comet was the only way to evacuate the Earth. And thus, 39 members of the cult decided to give themselves a game over screen. Yeah, so there's a lot more interesting things on Heaven's Gate. YouTuber Dantavious just did a really interesting video on this. Cults aren't my specialty, so I don't want to dive in too much, but if you want to know more, that's a great video and I'd recommend checking it out. Interplanetary contamination is actually a crucial thing to consider when planning space travel. It is basically bringing microbial life or an invasive species from one planet to a new planet where the life is foreign. There are two types of interplanetary contamination. Forward contamination is the transfer of life or other organisms from Earth to a foreign celestial body, and back contamination, which is the introduction of an extraterrestrial organism to Earth, which could have potentially dangerous consequences to all of humanity. If you have seen the film Alien, a good example of back contamination would be the crew of the Nostromo bringing the xenomorph back to Earth after being contaminated by such a parasitic species. Fortunately, there's rigorous protocol for spacecraft returning to Earth and any samples that spacecraft may have collected over its time in the cosmos and on another celestial body. And to prevent forward contamination, all spacecraft are pretty sterilized before they're sent out into the upper atmosphere and beyond. Although, in 2019, if you remember, there was an Indian spacecraft that crashed onto the moon. There was a sample of tardigrades in that spacecraft that some scientists now are worried that there is some sort of lineage of tardigrades that have been surviving on the moon for a while. But let's just hope there isn't some far dormant, terrible extraterrestrial parasite or virus that is lying dormant on a meteor headed to Earth. Let's just keep our fingers crossed. My friends, thank you so much for watching. I hope you found some entries you enjoyed, thought were mysterious, or thought were laughably dumb. This is part two of the iceberg of six parts. Expect part three and a new microphone, which I just got. I just didn't want to record with a new mic that's much better halfway through the video. Expect that next episode. Some smoother audio quality. I'll catch you all later. Thank you.